whatever is going on for us individually these days is necessarily being lived out against the backdrop of the dual traumas of the pandemic and the political turmoil that has unfolded so dramatically at the Capitol in the past week. We chant each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. Well, it seems this week the teacher has been working overtime, giving lessons in impermanence and interdependence. In Buddhist practice, we sometimes encounter the idea of interdependence, first in the form of ideas about oneness, and part of the experience of our practice can be one of escaping the kind of isolating, solitary sense of individuality, of the private inner self that struggles to make itself known to others or struggles to feel connected to the outside world. And much of our practice can be oriented towards breaking out of that shell into a realization that we can't be ourselves by ourselves, that who we are is inseparable from our contexts of being, our relational world or home, and that that kind of realization can initially be experienced as a great relief, a great joy. It can be a kind of revelatory alternative to our sense of isolation, separateness. And sometimes in meditation, people will report experiences of oneness, where they see their own face in everything, in everybody. They see themselves in the world. And these kinds of experiences that initially open us up from the shell of selfhood, we might say, unfortunately, don't stop there, because at some point we realize what we're connected to is the world of suffering. And we realize that so much of the shell of selfhood that we have been living in has been defensively maintained as a kind of attempt at autonomy, to keep ourselves undependent on others, unconnected, unvulnerable. That in a sense, the isolation that we've complained about has really been serving a function that we've been very reluctant to give up, walling us off from things that are very frightening. So that kind of oneness, when it turns over into a recognition of interdependency as part of interconnection, comes with it a strong sense of both vulnerability and responsibility. Some of you who have been following me on Facebook know I've been writing some notes on Heidegger's Being and Time. And he's trying to philosophically describe our place in the world, not in terms of separate subjects encountering objects out in the world or separate other individuals, but a kind of radical contextualism that offers an alternative to the Cartesian dualism of traditional Western philosophy. And so rather than talking about individual subjectivities, he has this word Dasein, which means being there, and combines the sense of being with there, where the being is being in the world. And he, in translating these long polysyllabic German words, you know, English translators usually have to resort to complex hyphenated words, like being in the world is one complex phrase. So Heidegger starts with this sense of our basic non-separation or embeddedness in the world as the fact of what we already are, not a special kind of oneness that we try to achieve through spiritual practices, but the way reality is already constituted, but we fail to recognize. Not so different, really, than Buddhism in some ways. But he also talks about an experience of anxiety, which comes about when we see something about the vulnerability associated with this embeddedness in the world. And for Heidegger, this comes about because the world we're embedded in, particularly the social world, is self-constituting. That is, that culturally and historically, we have created the norms that organize our life, and that we follow them basically by habit. And that we may tell our stories, self-stories about God giving us commandments or laws, or natural science organizing society in particular kinds of ways. But really, there's nothing holding it all up except the ongoingness of our practice. And Heidegger really talks about the recognition of our existential predicament in ways that are very reminiscent to me of the old cartoons about Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner. If you're old enough, you remember these, where this coyote seems to have only one mission in life, which is to catch and eat this Roadrunner bird. And he goes through more and more elaborate and desperate schemes to try to catch the bird who always eludes him. But one recurrent theme in these cartoons is that the coyote will chase that bird anywhere, no matter what. And often there's some scene in which he's chasing the bird right to the edge of the cliff, and the bird at the last minute dodges and veers off to the side, but the coyote in his pursuit ends up running straight off the cliff into space and just keeps running and running. And for a long time, because he's running so intently, he doesn't realize that there's no ground under him anymore. And then all of a sudden, there's a moment comes when he looks down and he sees there's nothing under his feet. There's just this abyss. And when he sees it, he falls. And for Heidegger, you have this kind of moment in which you realize all your life you've been running on thin air, that there's nothing under your feet. And that's when you have a real glimpse of reality. Now, I think that different traditions and practices see that kind of moment very differently, and perhaps it can have different kinds of effects. Psychoanalyst Bob Stalaro has written about those moments in terms of trauma, that they're characteristic of what happens when our whole relational world is shattered by some kind of traumatic event. It's not just that we experience a loss of even of a person, but we experience a loss of our world. We experience a loss of everything that has given us meaning and orientation. We lose not just the love of one, say, but we lose our bearings. We forget how we're supposed to live now without that person. And the healing of trauma is a complicated process of trying to re-knit the fabric of a lost world. In some traditions, however, like Zen, they talk about those kinds of moments as revelatory and liberating, when everything drops away, the self is empty, the world is empty, and we're freed from the constraints and constrictions of selfhood and social norms and expectations. It's interesting to think about what are the enabling conditions that constitute the possibility of a breakthrough rather than the experience of a breakdown. Some ways they're not that different, except for the container in which they happen. The traumatic breakdown has no container. Everything shatters. The breakthrough typically happens within the context of a practice, so that even as our sense of self is shattered, our sense of practice holds us up. Yeah, I was thinking of this in terms of what's going on in Washington now, where people's sense of what's expectable, what's reliable, what's trustworthy has in many cases been torn apart. People look at those images of the Capitol being stormed, and their reaction is a kind of, that can't be happening. That's not the world as I know it. I don't know how to imagine myself in a life where that kind of thing can be happening. And for others, the pandemic itself has been that. Not knowing how to imagine a world where life as usual simply has to stop, where everyone is suddenly vulnerable to sickness and death in a way that we didn't think would happen here. It's the kind of thing that happens in third world countries, someplace else. We don't imagine the cities of America and Europe being completely shut down by the plague. That's the kind of thing that happens in the Middle Ages, not now. So again, there's that kind of possibility of traumatic rupture of our known world. We don't know where it is we find ourselves. What I would like to suggest in terms of our practice is that we realize that if the first consequence of oneness is interdependency and vulnerability, the second is a sense of responsibility. That if we are constituted by this shared fabric of our existence, this shared social fabric, which is our daily equivalent of Indra's net, which binds all things together. If that's what's holding us up, when it tears, when it has a rupture as it has now, it's equally our responsibility to knit it back together. We may have forgotten that we're the ones who put it in place originally. And it's now our responsibility to maintain it. We maintain it by maintaining our democracy, which in a way is our broader social sangha. And we maintain it nearer at hand in our commitment and engagement in a Sangha like this one, where we don't just come as individuals to practice, having a valuable hour or two every day or every week that's good for our own personal psychology or personal growth. But we come together to create and maintain a Sangha. That sense of interconnection in the long run may be far more valuable than any kind of private personal experience you may have on the cushion when you're sitting. It's how you're part of something that holds and maintains you and who you are in your life. So in these traumatizing times, let's redouble our commitment to holding together and re-knitting the tears in Indra's net in our Sangha, in our democracy. It is our job together.